This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Central Africa is one of the poorest countries in the world and needs to be supported, but the people are focusing on the conflict, but it takes time for people to solve it.
That's Doctors Without Borders project coordinator in Central African Republic. He says attacks on civilians are increasing. Also today marks International May Day, and we'll find out if the needs and rights of Africa's largest workforce are being met. Drought continues to ruin harvest in Africa, and a top Muslim leader in northern Nigeria is under investigation for alleged embezzlement. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story today is May Day, a day when many countries celebrate workers. In sub-Saharan Africa, about three-fourths of those laborers work in the informal sector without contracts or job protections, according to the International Labor Organization. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi on the struggles those workers continue to face.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta pledged to tackle high unemployment during his speech at the annual May Day celebrations.
This day has been
satisfied. 100 metres away, 31-year-old Christine Dunge continues with her work selling sodas and snacks. She has been a street vendor at this public park in central Nairobi for several years. She says these days getting a job is hard. I have decided to employ myself so that I can survive. Like now, it is a rainy season. There are not enough customers to buy drinks. I motivate myself to continue selling because there is nowhere else I can work. In his address Monday, President Kenyatta announced that Kenya will be raising its minimum wage by 18%. The crowd cheered, but analysts say policies like raising the minimum wage won't help the majority of the workforce. According to the Kenyan government's 2017 economic survey, 833,000 jobs were created last year, but less than 20% of those jobs were in the formal sector. Kwame Owino is the CEO of the Institute of Economic Affairs in Kenya.
There's that disconnect. So on the one side, we have unions, which are talking for people who are in the formal sector, raising wages. And when that happens, when wages are raised from standard economics, one of the first things that happened is employment shrinks. So that employment shrinks in the formal sector, and most of these people fall back to the informal sector. We are solving the wrong problem.
He said Kenya and other African countries need to improve conditions for entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs in Africa often struggle to raise capital. Owino said what governments can do is to create new regulations, making it easier for small business to get loans. He said policymakers can also streamline the process of registering and running a legal business and make it cheaper. Kenya's national anthem played, signalling to the end of the celebration, and Josphat Mwendo, a trained mechanic, prepares to leave the park. After years of looking for a job, the 32-year-old just started fixing cars for money himself. He now has three people he pays to help him. He says, "I don't feel good because they did not speak about people like us. I think it is good to think about those who have employed themselves too, so that they can know their worth and also feel they're Kenyans like the rest." The problem is particularly acute among young people. A recent study by the Brookings Institute found that Africans between the ages of 15 and 24 are just a third of the continent's total working age population, but account for nearly two-thirds of the continent's unemployed. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Aid workers in the Central African Republic warn that the country may be sliding back into conflict. Tens of thousands of people have fled violence in the countryside over the past 6 months. More than half of the population relies on humanitarian aid. But the UN says relief efforts are dangerously underfunded. Zach Badorf traveled to the north of the country with the UN World Food Program and reports for VOA from the town of Paua.
Resurging violence in the Central African Republic has left some villages emptied and destroyed. 100,000 people have fled their homes since September. In the north, predominantly Christian anti-Balaka rebels used the town of Bambara as a base. But after they stole some cows from nearby nomadic people, the mostly Muslim ex-Seleka militia came for revenge, killing about 25 people and burning more than 600 houses. Alexei Finukile's big brother was killed and his house burned down.
My father died of old age, but when my big brother was killed, I was very shocked by that. I will always remember what happened here. That's the trace of the bullet. They shot at me, too.
The violence recalls the fighting and communal clashes that plunged the country into chaos nearly 4 years ago. Aid workers say the renewed violence has been a major setback. Fabrice Tiro works in northern CAR with the International Organization for Migration.
They don't have food, they don't have seeds, they don't have mats to sleep on, they don't have potable water. So everything was destroyed in these events, so they are starting from zero.
Meanwhile, at the camp for displaced persons in nearby Ndim, a group of herders have had to flee twice due to fighting over the past few months.
The future for us is truly in the hands of God, because the population of the nearby village are the ones protecting us. We don't have any say in the matter.
The village chief says the anti-Balaka attacked and stole about 150 of their cows. They moved and started growing maize and manioc, but they were attacked again. One-fifth of the country's population is currently displaced. Doctors Without Borders says civilians are being attacked at levels not seen in years. MSF runs a clinic in Pawa in the northwest of the country, but says it continues to struggle to access remote areas in need. Abdelkader Tijan is a project coordinator for MSF.
Central Africa is one of the poorest countries in the world and needs to be supported, but the people are focusing on the conflict. But it takes time for people to solve it.
Despite the growing need, the UN says just 10% of the required humanitarian funding for the year has been received. UN humanitarian coordinator Najat Rochdi says this could have a disastrous effect.
Otherwise, you know, we are just feeding the ground of armed groups who would come back to the population and just tell them, look, the international community, they don't care. The UN, they don't care. Look, you don't even have food on your table. You don't even have schools for your kids. So we need also, you know, just to fight against that.
The World Food Program has been forced to cut its food aid by almost half, from 700,000 people last year to 400,000 people this year. Zach Badorf for VOA News, Pauwa, Central African Republic.
Drought continues to ruin harvest in Africa and spread hunger throughout large parts of the continent. The UN and other organizations are providing short-term food relief. But one group, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, is supporting looking at the long term. It's introducing improved farming methods and technologies to boost production of small farmers. Joe DeVries is the group's vice president for program development and innovation. VOA's William Eagle asked him about helping farmers through drought.
Some of the practical examples of things we can do for smallholder farmers to help them increase their yields and improve their livelihoods are new seed. There's hardly anything that can benefit farmers more than packaging the power of higher yields in the seed and then putting that seed onto the market in packages that they can afford in villages where they live. And we've made a big breakthrough on this over the past decade. And the farmer demand has been huge. You know, we're now producing sufficient seed to plant around 12 million hectares every year with certified seed. And that's through about 100 or so private African seed companies and about 25,000 village-level agro-dealers who are selling this seed. Another area is just making water catchments available at village level so that the runoff water from the rains that do fall ends up in a stored area where farmers can make use of it during the rest of the season, especially during the dry years.
Africa is a net importer of about $40 billion worth of food each year. At the same time, the continent is becoming more and more urban. What efforts are underway to connect small farmers to towns and cities throughout either their country or even other African regions.
African agriculture is developing through millions of smallholder farmers increasing their yield. The problem there lies in if farmers are going to purchase seed and fertilizer and buy an irrigation pump, at the end of the season, they need to be able to sell the surpluses that they don't need to feed themselves into a market. And they need to be able to do that efficiently. And at the moment, Africa's smallholder grain markets are not operating efficiently. In many cases, farmers are selling to the nearest middleman at the side of the road at throwaway prices. And what we need to do is ensure that they have the knowledge, first of all, to know what the market is asking from them, the quality of the grain. Help them to aggregate that into larger loads is the second intervention. And then I think invest in the African grain trading sector. You know, it's not that we don't have quality, highly skilled grain merchants, but for a long time, you know, these people have never had access to credit in order to modernize their operations, put in drying facilities, put up warehouses that would allow them to store grains for long periods of time. And instead, we're just working in open-air markets, which may look efficient, but the losses are high. And the quality of the grain that can be delivered through that kind of a system just isn't good enough to compete with imported grain.
Some say one way of curbing migration and even terrorism is by getting youth involved in farming. How do you make farming lucrative enough to encourage young people to stay in rural areas rather than go to urban ones seeking employment?
We can educate young people to produce crops more efficiently, using better technology. They tend to be the ones who are the most interested and get the use of technology. They're using smartphones. They're linked into urban markets. So what we're looking at doing now is just basically running people through a rapid training facility. And this is not operational yet, but it's in our minds to do. Just recruit people between the ages of 18 and 25 years old, people who've got some level of education and are able to operate efficiently if they know where the opportunities are. The opportunities are in vegetable production. The opportunities are in export crop production. And there's also opportunities in marketing of surplus grains that are now starting to appear on Africa's markets.
That was Joe DeFries of the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. He spoke with reporter William Eagle. The tropics are home to the greatest diversity of plants and animals on Earth. However, due to the rapid growth of commercial, illegal, and subsistence hunting, a majority of tropical mammal and bird populations are in severe decline, especially within 40 kilometers of roads and settlements. That's according to a new report in the journal Science. It analyzed 176 studies of hunting and tropical ecosystems. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Ana Betitez Lopez, an ecologist at Radboud University in the Netherlands and the study's lead author.
I did this project on the impact of hunting on tropical mammal and bird populations because to date, we did not have a large-scale estimate of the effect of hunting pressure across the tropics on wildlife, and we were not really aware of what was going on. Only the more popular species like elephants or rhinos, we were aware of what was going on, but there are a bunch of other species which are practically being decimated, and nobody was really reporting this. The biodiversity we have in our planet is the result of thousands of years of evolution, and I think that's a legacy we must preserve. Besides that, many people in the tropics rely on these wildlife populations as a main source of food. So when these populations disappear, the livelihoods of these people are also threatened. That's something that we also have to tackle.
Give me a sense of the extent of the devastation that your study found.
We found around 80% of mammal populations are reduced due to hunting, and around 58% of bird populations. This is taking into account over 200 species of mammals and around 100 species of birds. So a pretty good representation of the wildlife we have in the tropics.
Give me an example of a mammal, a small mammal that we may not know about, that has been substantially endangered recently because of hunting?
Yeah, one of the most threatened species nowadays is the pangolin. This is because the scales of these animals are used in the Chinese traditional medicine. Most of the Asian species are critically endangered. Now the African species are being hunted and traded illegally to China for commercial purposes and to sell these scales, which are really valuable in the legal market. For birds, we could talk about curassows, toucans, hornbills, and guans. These are the birds that are the most threatened, I would say.
They hunt toucans, and do they eat toucans?
Yes, but some birds are hunted because of their feathers, and they're used in rituals, or they are traded in the market. This was not part of my study, but in Southeast Asia, people are going crazy about birds, and they have them as pets in their houses. So many of them are traded alive. So it's a global problem.
What would you say is the major cause of the endangerment of these mammals and birds? Is it the commercial or is it the food-seeking peoples? How does the commercial and the human need factor play out in this catastrophe?
Commercial hunting has a larger effect on biodiversity on mammals and birds. And this is because basically people hunt just to make money out of it and then sell the body parts and the meat in markets. This is also related to an increasing demand also from urban areas which seek wild meat as a delicacy. Nonetheless, subsistence hunting has also an impact. And probably this is because a lot of indigenous communities have transitioned now from traditional techniques using a bow and arrow to using shotguns. So they are better, basically, at hunting, or they're more efficient. It's also true that in some communities, this is a cultural tradition, and it's difficult to unroot people from what they've been doing all their lives. For centuries, people have been hunting in the tropics and nothing happened. But today, the problem is that we have increasing human population that is demanding more and more resources. And then we have to find a balance to see if we can look for alternative livelihoods for some of the communities. But again, commercial hunting has much larger effect on wildlife populations.
That was Ana Benitez-Lopez, a research scientist at Radboud University in the Netherlands. She spoke via Skype with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Coming up on 23 minutes past the hour, this is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. A top Muslim leader in northern Nigeria is under investigation for alleged embezzlement. AFP reports investigators are checking the accounts of the Emir of Kano, Muhammadu Sanusi II. The investigation reportedly centers on $19 million in palace funds that were allegedly spent on luxury cars, chartered flights, and other personal expenses. However, the Emirate Council denies it ever bought a Rolls Royce for the Emir, adding any cars were given as gifts from friends. The council treasurer says the Emir always buys airline tickets with his personal funds and that the Kano state government approved his spending. Critics of the probe say it may be linked to the Emir's attempts to bring about reforms in a conservative area. In his previous job as Nigeria's central bank governor, he allegedly had fraud cost the state-run oil company $20 billion. Well, Tunisia was the birthplace of the Arab Spring uprisings of 2011. But 6 years later, it stands alone among the Arab Spring countries in undertaking a democratic transition. Despite progress, daunting challenges remain. Amin Ghali is program director of Al-Kawakibi Democracy Transition Center in Tunis. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about the biggest challenges facing the transition.
We have a number of challenges facing the Tunisian transition. One of them is security. Tunisia is facing a big challenge of security, internal security challenge, but also a regional security, mainly because of the Libyan problem. At our border, we have a country that is almost a stateless country, where violent groups are almost governing every aspect of life in Libya, and it has adversely impacted the transition in Tunisia. The other challenge, the main challenge of Tunisian transition, is the economic transition. We had delays in addressing the economic reform of the country. Now, after 6 years of the transition in Tunisia, we still need to reform the economy, because at the end of the day, this is what matters to the general public. People in Tunisia are happy with election, are happy with freedom, the new freedom that they have, but they are very much frustrated with the lack of the economic opportunities, with the lack of a new model of the economy of the country. And when we are late delivering on the economy, we are starting to see some suspicion and some deception from the transformation process all over.
How about corruption as a barrier to transition?
From day one after the revolution, we've discovered that corruption is a systematic problem in the country. We are trying our best to limit it, to downscale it, and to fight it. There has been some delays in this fight. And now, since 2016, maybe in 2017, the issue of fighting corruption is back on the table of the public debate. It's back on the political agenda. We are going, I would say, some good steps toward this fight, but it's still a big, big challenge, and we need a lot of reform processes, a lot of resources to fight this cancer of the transition.
How optimistic you are of prospects for successful transition to democracy in Tunisia?
Well, of course, I'm very optimistic about this process. We have to be optimistic, otherwise we will fail. But something we need to keep in mind, transition is not a linear process. It doesn't go from A to B or A to Z. It goes through a different steps. It goes through ups and downs. It goes from in loops. It goes all direction. But we need to look into the general trend. We had very different phases of the transition, down phases, up phases, but the general trend is positive. It's very important to keep the optimistic approach to this transition, to convince people to remain engaged into this process and to help everyone from his own side to help the success of the transition. It is time to do a midway assessment. The general assessment is rather positive, but many other things or many components need to be improved.
How can the international community, especially the United States, help reaching a successful transition in Tunisia?
Before knowing what needs to be done from international partners in Tunisia, we need to keep in mind that the success of the Tunisian transition is not only for Tunisia. The success of the Tunisian transition is for the Arab region, is the hope for countries that are going through dictatorship, countries that have had delays in triggering a genuine process of transition. So helping Tunisia is beyond Tunisia, is helping all of these repressed countries, all of these repressed people. In more pragmatic terms, most of the help needs to be directed toward the economic reform. But we should keep in mind that the economic reform is very much linked to a political reform, to a transitional reform. We have to invest in all of these actors of change, try to help reform processes, laws, administration. All of this needs to be done in Tunisia to keep this hope that transition, at the end of the day, delivers to the people.
Amin Ghali is program director of Al Kawakibigi Democracy Transition Center in Tunis. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the latest political developments in Zambia. Will President Edgar Lungu declare a state of emergency after public buildings were torched in attacks? He blames the violence on opposition members protesting the arrest of their leader, Hakainde Hichilema. An in-depth discussion on Zambia on the next Straight Talk Africa.
voaafrica.com.
On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.